Hey, welcome back to English History, Fact and Fiction, episode the 319th, The Rebellion of 45. And yes, we are finally at the story of Bonnie Prince Charlie. Let's get on with it. Yeah, J.S. Sparks got to be a bit of an old guy by now, so it's his son's taken over the family business. That was a bit of W.F. Bach Symphonia for Strings. To get us underway, we had left it with Willie, Duke of Cumberland, going down to Marshal Saxe, the Frenchie. And I have to say, though, Willie actually did okay with his own command in the centre. At one stage, the Frenchies were trying to talk Louis XV into running away, thinking that they had lost the battle to Willie. But Willie failed with the overall army thingy. Perhaps he should have stayed at the back to direct, but he wanted to be a big brave boy and lead from the front. At the end then, it's a bloodbath with about 15,000 corpses, perhaps evenly split. But Frenchy morale can go up with their team back to being the one to beat on the battlefield. Marshal Saxe is likewise now probably the number one military guy in Europe and not our Willie. But we might want to blame Willie for not only failing to direct the battle well, but also ignoring some pretty good advice from his more experienced subordinates. Willie, though, will blame the Dutchies, and one of his guys will be court-martialed with history saying, "Yeah, that was a bad result. You just stitched that guy up, Willie." And as for the Dutchies, well, I can tell you, my dear listener, that they had an organised withdrawal, and they did not do the running away stuff. We're blaming Willie, but that's not the point. The point is, it's seen as a big win for France and a loss for England, and the Jacobites are all happy, happy, joy, joy. Now is the time for action, while Britain is demoralised and George is headed over to Hanover for some me time. Charles will send send a letter to John Murray of Broughton saying, "Hey guys, I'll be seeing you in July." John Murray will later claim that he had written back saying, "Look, don't come unless you've got at least 6,000 hard men with you." Charles either didn't get the letter or tossed it away or it never existed. It doesn't matter really, because he would have ignored that advice anyway. He's a young hothead. Finally, he will write to his dad. "I have taken a firm resolution to conquer or to die." Yeah, he's not going to die. Spoiler there. "And to stand my ground as long as I have a man remaining with me." Yes, he's saying he wants some glory. 16th of July, 1745. We're off in two ships, the Dutilly and the Elizabeth, which was a 68-gun ship with 700 men on board. Oh, well, that's not too bad. On the Dutilly, the Prince was one of the magnificent seven Jacobite big dicks, known as the Seven Men of Moidart. Moidart is a remote Scotty island. But who are our magnificent seven? Duke of Athol, Francis Strickland, Sir Thomas Sheridan, Charles's one-time tutor, George Kelly, Aeneas MacDonald, John O'Sullivan, and St. John MacDonald. And yes, you can now forget all their names. Bunch of nobodies, really. Do we care about them? No, we do not. Do we have a plan? Oh, yes, we do. Excellent. We're going to sail around Cornwall, then up the west coast of Ireland. That's a bit tricky. That's in the Atlantic. Then on to the Hebrides, the northwest of Scotland. All those islands up there. Now, as we sail past the Lizard... The Lizard? Have we had the Lizard before? It's just a little bit of stuff in Cornwall. It's mainly a road now. So we're sailing past, and in comes a big old British warship, Ubugger. The Elizabeth will give battle and get beaten up a bit, so return to Brest. That's half our ships gone, and all of our 700 hard men gone. Advice to Charles is that he should return to France. Not a bloody chance, mate. All on its lonesome, the little Dutilly will continue north to Scotland. 23rd of July, 1745, and here we are at the Outer Hebrides. Here's an eagle to hover over the ship. "Oh, it's the King of Birds come to welcome your Royal Highness upon your arrival in Scotland." yeah, that's the start and the end of the good news for Charles. One of the guys will go ashore because his brother-in-law should be there to welcome them, but that brother-in-law is nowhere to be found. Suddenly, a suspicious-looking ship appears close by, so our ship will run away to find somewhere else to drop off our heroes. It will be the island of Eriskay, known to this very day as Prince's Shore. And you will not be visiting, my dear listener, or really extremely unlikely, but if you do, it would need to be pissing down with rain and very windy for you to feel the way Charles did. Charles allegedly dropped a packet of seeds he had bought from France. Yeah. Convolvulus, which to this day continues to grow along the path where Charles wandered. Romantic crap. So while you're probably familiar with the Skybait song, there was lots of music written about Bonnie Prince Charlie in Scotland. That one's just called Bonnie Prince Charlie. Charles will spend the night in a rough shack, then return to the Du Tillet in the morning. Here comes Alexander MacDonald. Oh, he's just come across 2 miles of water from the island of South West. This will be a big meeting because the MacDonalds are one of the largest clans and Stuart supporters. Oh, yay! Not. MacDonald will say, we want nothing to do with you. You should just go home, kiddo. I am come home, says Charles. 19th of August, 1745, and the Royal Standard will be raised at Glenfinnan at the head of Loch Shiel. The Jacobite Rebellion, known as the 45, has begun in a lovely, tranquil setting. Very pretty. A lovely calm summer's day. Might perhaps be just a bit too tranquil. A large noisy army might be a bit more welcome. But no, there's about 250 MacDonalds, and that's it. A couple of hours later, though, when we hear the pipes, this will be about 700 hairy Highlanders, mainly the Camerons, and then about another 300 MacDonalds. Well, that's an army of at least 1,000 guys. What had happened is that more guys came in, like our first guy, the MacDonald, to say, hey, Charles, we ain't up for it and you should go home. The less than magnificent 6 out of 7 were also saying, look, it's a dud, we should go back to France. But Charles remained totally optimistic and turned on the charm and slowly he's managed to get some guys on board. His optimism and enthusiasm and perhaps the odd promise that the Frenchies will be in to support have won at least some of the chiefs over to his side. London has put £30,000 up for the capture of Charles Edward Stuart. Head of the government forces in Scotland, Sir John Cope will march to meet Charles, and Charles will march to meet Sir John. He's keen to do Cope over before he can be reinforced from England. Both are headed to Coriach Pass, and Charles will get there first and set up a trap. Sir John will say, hey, if I'd got here first, I would have set up a trap, so I bet Charles did. And so Sir John will march away to Inverness. Sir John has left the road to Edinburgh open. Ooh, that's nice, so Charles will take that offer and not follow him to Inverness. Psychological victory to the Jacobites. As they march, more Scotties will join in. Charles will get done up in a nice tartan suit with gold lace. Sounds awful to me. Enter Perth, and now he has some genuine big dicks on the team. Duke of Perth, Lord Nand, Lord George Murray, Lord Ogilvy, Lord Strathallan, Macpherson of Cluny, Oliphant of Gask, and Robert Mercer of Aldie. And a dicky bird. It will be a week in Perth taking donations and drilling the troops. troops drilled, and we can march on Edinburgh. Charles does not have the manpower to take the city, and he's got no time for a siege, so he'll just demand surrender. Can we have some time to think about it, say the city elders. Sure you can. 2 hours. 2 hours pass, and the city elders come back looking for an extension. That will be a no. Make up your minds. Meanwhile, Charles had posted some hairy Highlanders near one of the gates of Edinburgh. As the deputation returned, the Highlanders will charge on in through the open gates, and holding those gates, in comes Charles's army. Going well, is it not? How exciting. Here comes Charles on his horsey with the full fancy dress on and nice medals, looking like a genuine fairy tale prince. Women are getting just a tad excited, and here is Holyrood Palace just waiting for Charles. Holyrood, the home of Stuart kings for generations. Jim Six had gone from here to be 1 and 6 of England and Scotland. 60 years ago, Charles's grandparents, Jim II and his Mrs. Mary Beatrice, had lived there. 35 years ago, his dad, Jim III, had caught a glimpse of the palace from his ship before it turned round and went back to France. But now our bonny Prince Charlie has truly come home. At the Market Cross you will find the magistrates, heralds, trumpeters and hangers-oners all gathered to proclaim the new King James III of England and Ireland and James VIII of Scotland. Oh, and that royal German family in London are going to be really pissed off for the Scotties. Why, totally pissed off. And here it comes again, the reward. He's offered £30,000 for the pretender. Charles will put up a reward of £30,000 for George, who's still in Hanover. George will write to his lad, Willie, saying be ready to bring in duchy troops if needed. George will come back to England to show everyone he is in a excellent mood. No panicking about Jacobite rebellions to see now, George. Prince Fred will offer his services to the king and country, and that will be a no thanks. Fred has had nothing to do with the military. George will receive plenty of reports on the state of play, which are a bit alarming, but he is cool, calm and collected. Time for Biff. No takeover is complete without Biff, and our government man, Sir John Cope, has turned up with his army. A council of war, and Charles will be very pleased that we decide to attack immediately. The Jacobites will march out to meet the enemy. We're about evenly matched, with each side having around about 2,500 guys. 20th September 1745, the two armies are camped opposite each other with a big old bog in between. Cope should be confident. The Jacobites are poorly armed. He's got some decent terrain, including walls where he can place his cannon. But some of our hairy Highlanders know the secret path through the secret bog. A small party of Highlanders will get through that secret path and surprise the motherfucker out of some government dragoons. These dragoons are led by an officer, James Gardner, who will promptly crap his dacks and start yelling, "Run away! Run away!" Okay, bring on Cope's well-armed infantry. They may have good weapons, but so far their training's been in building roads. Oh, well. He's got some cannon and borrowed some sailors who know how to make cannon go bang. The sailors are all, oh, so it's called a cannon then. What does it do? Oh, shit. Sir John has sent an urgent message to Edinburgh saying, send me some gunners. But the message failed to arrive. Charles is all gung-ho. Let's get stuck in. On his team are some senior guys, including Lord George Murray, sixth son of the Duke of Athol, and rather smart military guy. He'll say, no, Charles, sending your guys charging through a bog at well-armed guys with cannon to support them would be stupid. That will lead to a big old fight between the two. This time, Murray will get his way, and at the end of the day, the battle was won anyway in about 10 minutes, with about 100 Jacobites dead and 500 government forces dead. The point here, though, is that George Murray's the military brain, but it is Charles in charge. One thing I like is that Lieutenant Colonel Whitefoot, the artillery commander, found his guys all running away. In came a Stuart from Inverhale, who said, off you go, laddie. White Ford will repay that favour next year at Culloden. Yeah, he will save that Stuart guy from death. There will be court martials for Cope and a couple of the senior guys. All three will be acquitted, but really, it hasn't done much at all for Cope's career.
to the heather, around and gather, you're all the welcome or early. Around and cling, we are your kin for Warwick King the Jelly. Come through the heather, around and gather, you're all the welcome or early. To crown your rightful lawful king for Warwick King the Jelly.
Yeah, who'll be king but Charlie? Well, George reckons he's the king, mate, that's who. This was really a lucky break for the Jacobites, but they're in a we won mood. They have the colours captured from the Dragoons, and their pipers are piping, and they're marching back to Edinburgh with their heads held high. Charles is the all-conquering hero, and everyone wants to be a Jacobite. Plenty of cheering and waving and bonfires and bells ringing wahoo. George is still cool, calm and collected. He doesn't place a lot of value on the hairy Highlanders when compared to his lad, Willie, Duke of Cumberland, and the veterans from Fontenoy are on their way from Europe. Charles will issue orders that the enemy wounded be properly cared for and captured officers are to be treated with dignity. The public also need to behave properly. These guys are his subjects. They might be misguided. They might have an unhappy way of thinking about who is the real king, but Charles is here on a humanitarian cause to liberate the British people from the cruel and oppressive tyranny of the German kings. Charles will be the moderate, all-forgiving, nice king, the king we all want. Okay, great, what's next? Well, Marshal Wade is on his way, heading towards Newcastle with government troops. Lord grant that Marshal Wade may by thy mighty aid victory bring. Hear that, guy? Sorry about the singing. Sorry. I'll try not to do it. Charles wants to head out to meet him for some biff. He's got a council by now and they'll be saying, yeah, no, that's not doable. We've got a small, badly equipped army with no cavalry. The Highlanders are all just volunteers and just as likely to wander off home to store their plunder or harvest their crops or just for a darn good rogering of the missus. Just stick around in Edinburgh, Charles, and watch your army grow. More chieftains will join in now they've seen your mighty victory. Denounce the Act of the Union and become the King of Scotland as a nice big start. And Charles wants to be King of Britain, not King of Scotland. Right now, though, he is the 24-year-old ruler of Scotland. He's going to get some taxation going. He's issued proclamations. He's going to send ambassadors to France. He'll write to the chieftains, urging them to get on board, and he'll review his army. Night times will be Charles holding court, with the women in particular flocking in. Charles will be cool and distant towards the young, hot, Scotty chicks. He prefers male company. There will be zero scandal and absolutely no bastard Stuart slipped behind. After 6 weeks in Edinburgh, the council agree it is time to march to England. Charles wants to go straight to Newcastle for biff with Wade. Murray wants to go via Carlisle to the northwest of England, where there's a good chance that people will declare for Team Jacobite. Murray will win the argument. 1st of November 1745 and off we go with now around 5,000 guys. And 8 days later, we are in England. In the meantime, Charles's young brother Henry was beside himself, wanting to go and join Big Brother. Eventually, he snuck off and got to Avignon to wait for orders from Louis XV. November saw him in Paris. Great timing, because the news is in of all the successes of Charles. Taking Edinburgh, victory at Preston Pans, that's the one he won against Sir John Cope, and the invasion of England. Stuart Street cred is up. Louis had already sent some support. 4 small ships with volunteers, weapons, and the Marquis d'Aquila. Right now, Louis is thinking of sending more substantial support. Louis and James will sign the Treaty of Alliance. France will help Charles against their common foe. The common foe is the Elector of Hanover, not England. Time for Louis to meet young Henry. It's hardly auspicious because Louis was pretty shy with strangers, so there were plenty of awkward pauses. Henry was travelling incognito as the Count of Albany, so we've got all sorts of protocol problems. Louis will be non-committal on further aid. Even so, a big old invasion force will be assembled on the coast. Nominally, this is Henry's show, but Louis sent the Duc de Richelieu to do the actual command work. Henry is totally devout, and the Duke is not. The Duke is promiscuous, relaxed, worldly, so these two will not get on well at all. The councils of war will often degenerate into squabbles. But things will progress, and there goes 1,000 Scotties off on a big old frigate. Finally, in December, we're ready to embark 12,000 hard men commanded by the Duke de Richelieu. Won't happen, bad weather. Meanwhile, Charles had marched to Carlisle. It has neglected defences and an elderly garrison. It thought the Jacobite army was way bigger than it was, and these guys believed the olden day stories about hairy Highlanders eating English children for dinner. Message off to Field Marshal Wade. Help wanted. Message back. You're on your own. 6 days later, Carlisle will surrender. The real battle, though, is going on inside the Jacobite army. Lord Murray was co-top dog with the Duke of Perth, John Drummond. This was stupid from the start. Any more than one guy in charge is a bad idea, and the Duke of Perth was just given the rank because he's the senior noble, not that he's any good at the military. Murray and Drummond then have been squabbling. Murray will spit the dummy and resign in writing. Charles will accept and say, OK, Drummond's now in charge. What the absolute fuck, say the entire army. Drummond's got no idea about the military. Murray is the go-to guy for the military, so we ain't having it. Fortunately, Drummond knows that they're all right. He knows he's no good at it, so he'll step down if Murray agrees to come back. All right, says sulky puss Murray. The army is heading south. It's a bit smaller now with the inevitable desertions. Charles Ho is an exemplary leader, walking with the men rather than riding his horsey, and making sure they are all tucked into bed before he went to sleep. He'll praise guys who do good stuff and be mild with those who stuff up. Trouble is, the army should be growing with all those northwestern Jacobites, but it isn't. At Manchester, a sergeant, his girlfriend and a drummer will go ahead to do a bit of recruiting. That will score a couple of hundred more for the army. Charles will arrive looking magnificent, and James will once again be proclaimed king. Off again towards Derby, where they hear that George's lad, Willie, Duke of Cumberland, will be blocking the road to London. A cunning plan. Murray will lead a small force southwest, so it looks like we're headed to Wales. That will work. Willie will fall back, ready to hint to Wales, while Murray can rejoin the main army, and in we go to Derby. Well, that'll be nice. Bells ringing, bonfires cheering and waving. Charles will have every reason to feel good. He's come 500 miles and doesn't need 500 more. Just another 100 would see him in London. Well, he's going to have to move very fast if he wants to come in between Charles and London. London is in a panic. Without Willie, all they've got is militia. And that's not likely to put up much resistance. London is panicking, as they do. There's been a run on the banks. It's been 57 years since William of Orange turned up, causing James II to do a runner. Will George run is the big question. Rumours, as usual, are rife. George has got a luxury yacht gassed up and good to go. Willie's army has deserted over to Charles. The ministry are having urgent peace talks with Charles, and who knows what else. It's all just crap. Louis XV is chatting with King Charles Emmanuel of the Sardines in Sardinia to see what terms they will offer George after he goes down. Perhaps we should leave him as King of England with the Stuarts going back to being Kings of Scotland, is the thought. Then we can go back to the old alliance between France and Scotland to keep the Poms on their toes. Willie will be brought to London to make extra preparations for a French invasion, while Marshal Wade, by thy mighty aid, victory bring, will be retired in favour of Henry Worley. It's not going gloriously well for our dashing Bonnie Prince. Good time, then, for it all to go to hell. Yeah, I think this is the point where it all falls to bits, my dear listener. We are in Derby. It'll be a big old council meeting. Decision is retreat. What? Retreat? Yeah, well, Murray will point out that you've got your Willie Duke of Cumberland army heading our way, Then you got your Lord Grant that Marshal Way, made by the mighty Victory Bring Army, also heading our way. And Charles, oh mate, there happens to be a third force waiting for us at Finchley. Now Charles, here's the thing. Any one of those three armies could do us like a dinner, and there's three of them. So, yeah, we need to retreat. If all those English Jacobites existed in reality instead of just existing in your brain, that might be a different matter. But you have to admit, there are thousands of Jacobites rushing in to join us. It might also be a different matter if that Frenchy army had turned up. But neither of those things happen. So, we are a little bit stuffed. What we are is a big bunch of Scotty invaders who have strayed a bit too far from home, and we need to get back and have a good hard think about what will be next. We're all keen as mustard to see the silly hat go on your dad's head and to get his bum on the big chair, but right now, old love, it is not doable.
Gotten for a king, but a wee bit German lairdy. When we come to bring him home, he was delving in his yearday. Shook and kale and laying leeks, but the holes and but the breeks, and up his beggar duds he creaks, this wee bit German lairdy.
So, our Jacobite songs are not only pro-Charles, they're also anti-George, as that one demonstrates. Charles can't believe what's going on. This will bring out the worst in him. He will be petulant. He will shout and abuse the officers. He'll become incoherent. But none of that will change anyone's mind. Now, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, I have to tell you, he is the Supreme Commander. So he could order an attack on someone, on London. But no, it's going to be retreat, with nobody quite game to tell the hairy Highlanders. The retreat will start at dawn the next day, and this will give us one of the biggest what-ifs we've had. What if Charles had decided to attack? We know that lots of the English guys are hardly what you call professional soldiers. Modern historians reckon that Charles was right and the council was wrong. His guys were super pumped up, and as we have seen, hairy Highlanders coming charging on in with their axes can scare the absolute shit out of English armies. Charles had landed 5 months ago with half a dozen guys, and here he is, just 3 or 4 days' march outside of London. A fast march would have seen Charles get to London before Willie. The army at Finchley was the weakest, having been cobbled together with promises of bonus payments. The government troops at Preston Pans had been useless, and there's no reason why these three armies should be any better. London was where you could find more than the odd Jacobite, and George wasn't doing that well in the popularity stakes. A fast takeover by Charles would have seen us all happy with the Frenchies once more. On the other hand, well, maybe Prince Fred could have leapt into action. We're just never going to ever know, sadly. Never know, because our lads now need to retreat. That's the orders from the top. And this is going to be a different Charles. No longer the first out of bed to rally the guys. No longer at their head marching briskly. He'll just get up, jump on his horsey, and gallop off to the next destination. He is being a very big sulky puss. He's also looking to slow down the march, hoping that some of the English might catch up for some biff. By the time they got back to Carlisle, he and Murray were hardly on speaking terms. Charles will want to leave a garrison at Carlisle. It's his one English fortress that he's taken. Murray can only shake his head, but that garrison will be left. 10 days later, in comes Willie, our fun-loving Duke of Cumberland, and why not find out why he's known as Bill the Butcher Cumberland? Half the captured officers will score the hung and drawn and quartered torture death, with the other half, plus the men, sent to the American plantations for a bit of slavery called indentured servitude. Nasty stuff. 20th of December, the Jacobite army is back in Scotland. Things have changed. Government troops have taken back Edinburgh, and some clans who were previously neutral have turned against the Stuarts. Presbyterian Glasgow will not provide a warm welcome, although he will get 60 new recruits. That won't make up for 600 who have snuck off home.
saw the gharry, saw ye the lads with their bonnets and white cagats, down from their mountains to follow Prince Jerry. Follow ye, we would not follow ye, lang have ye loved us and trusted us fairly. Cherry, Cherry, we would not follow ye, king o' the healing caps, bonnie Prince Cherry.
Yeah, a good recruiting song, that's what the Jacobites need, and there it was. Charles will want to have a crack at Stirling Castle. Dick of an idea, says Murray. Waste of time and energy, and you should have discussed it with us first. You've got an army of volunteers, not mercenaries. Charles will say, I'm sick of hearing about it being an army of volunteers. They should have more zeal, more resolution, and more good manners than a normal old army. Okay, off we go to besiege Stirling. We're in Scotland in winter, so Charles will, of course, get a runny nose. It'll be bed rest for the lad at the home of Sir Hugh Paterson of Bannockburn and his lovely niece, Clementina Walkinshaw. And yes, she was named after Charles's mum, who was actually Clementina's godmother. Charles and Clementina probably played together as little kiddies. Charles will extend his visit by 10 days. Clementina is considered to be plain, but I have to say I find she's got lovely eyes, a cute smile, and perhaps that largish nose works for her. I think she's a cutie. What else about her? She is softly spoken and sensible. Not like the other girls at Holyrood, all beautiful and vivacious and seductive and throwing themselves at Charles. This will be very nice for Charles. It's a woman he can talk to. It seems like there was no hanky or panky that went on during the 10 days. Charles made Clementina promise to come to him if he ever needed her again. It will be 7 years before the call comes, so it doesn't look like any red-hot love affair going on. Okay, runny nose is over, and government forces under General Henry Hawley are on the move from Edinburgh. We need to march out to meet them, but stupid Charles doesn't want to entirely give up the siege of Stirling Castle, so 1,000 guys will be left behind. Murray thinks that's a dick of an idea, but he's got to go along with it. 17th of July, 1746, and the two armies will meet near Falkirk. Our first battle at Preston Pans took 10 minutes, but this one will be much longer. 20 minutes. And I kid you not, on either of those, the first one was 10 minutes, the second one 20 minutes. Neither team's got decent leadership. Hawley underestimated the Highlander numbers and their fighting ability. He thought his cavalry could just ride them down. Meantime, Charles is all over the place, with Charles and Murray arguing, and some senior guys are thinking, Murray's a traitor. Let's get to the battle. The Highlanders have the high ground. Hawley thinks they're way too chicken to attack. Stupid Hawley. He'll delay until it starts to rain and snow heavily, with a stiff breeze blowing right at the government troops. That's when he'll order his dragoons to march up the hill towards the Highlanders. The dragoons think this order is a bit stupid. But an order's an order, so off they go, churning up the ground with their horses so the cannon can't be moved in position to support them. Dragoons will halt and form positions with another line of infantry coming in behind. The government troops will advance on the Macdonalds. Just like the Preston Pans, the Jacobites will fire at them, and just like Preston Pans, the government troops will run away. Before you know it, panic has set in and the whole of the government guys will be on the run. The Macdonalds can rush on down and loot their camp. The storm is on, so in the bad light, the Jacobites will have some casualties. Maybe 50 dead for them to the government's 70 dead, with about 300 wounded or missing. The government army lost all cohesion, with some guys ending up in Falkirk and others in Edinburgh. Archie Cunningham, commander of the artillery, abandoned his guns in his rush to run away, and he'll end up committing suicide over that. It's another win for the Jacobites, but a poor win. The Duke of Perth was in charge of the left wing, but he'd wandered off somewhere. Murray asked Charles to replace him, but Charles said no. So the left wing of the Jacobite army just stood there, with nobody to say charge or fire or whatever. We also have this guy, John O'Sullivan, who is one of those Irish wild geese. He has a bunch of Irish on loan from the Frenchies with him. He and Charles were so confused about what was going on, they thought they had been done over. Guys went running off to Stirling to tell the Jacobite besiegers there that the army had been defeated. Total cock-up. The government also had Frenchies with them, Huguenots, and one of these was François Ligonier, who had been wounded at that Battle of Dettingen. He came off his sickbed to be involved in this battle. The snow and the rain will do him. Pleurisy and death for François. Henry Hawley must be charmed, because there'll be no court-martial for him, even though he'd even left his wounded behind. That's very naughty for a commander. But perhaps it was because we're pretty sure he was one of German George's bastards, which would make him a half-brother to the king and perhaps explain why there was no court-martial. Team government were shitty, and the Jacobites failed to follow up. Why am I here, you ask? Well, Murray wanted a follow-up, but Charles said no. He wanted Stirling Castle first. It will only take Charles about 10 days to work out that he has totally stuffed this up. It is winter. Totally shit time for guys to be sitting outside the walls of a bloody castle. The troops are not happy and will grumble and fight among each other, and the smart ones will wander off. And, oh dear, the news is in that Willie, Duke of Cumberland, has arrived in Edinburgh to take charge of the government forces. Now, Willie was very different to Henry Hawley, who was all stick and no carrot. Willie is affable, not a tyrant. He's the second son of George, but he's still the favourite, and we all know it. Willie is the type of leader who wants to look after his troops, attending to their welfare, and the troops appreciate that. Oh, okay, says Charles, let's march and follow up on our glorious victory. Listen, shit for brains, says Murray. Follow-ups happen immediately, not bloody 10 days later. Murray will put it in writing, and the other chiefs will sign off with him. We cannot attack, we have to retreat. We have to run away to the Highlands and prepare for a spring offensive. Oh, we just had one of those, haven't we? Ukraine versus Russia with the spring offensive. But I have no idea who came up with that dick of an idea. You see, my dear listener, the Russians certainly know a shit ton about defence. Jesus, do they not know about defence? They are brilliant at it. The Ukrainians are pushing shit uphill. Even if they had artillery and air support that is really, really needed for what they were supposed to do, but they didn't even have it. So, as I understand it, the US thought Ukraine troops would win because they're fighting for freedom and democracy. Yeah, you might as well say God is on our team. Let's get back to Charles, because I don't think God's on his team. Although he keeps winning, doesn't he, I suppose. Maybe God's on his team, maybe not. Charles will read the letter from Murray and say, oh yeah, terribly sensible, and that is what we shall do. No, nothing like that. He's going to go nuts and start bashing his own head against the wall. Good God, have I lived to see this? Yeah, you have, Charlie, old mate. Why should the conquerors of Falkirk flee from the conquered? Why should they be any better off, say, in Perth than they are now? What would the Frenchies think of them if they were to retreat? Or the Spaniards? What would become of their lowland allies? Were they going to abandon them to the fury of our merciless enemies? What encouragement would this give to others to support them? Charles, 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 you farted about in Stirling when you should have been up Henry Hawley all the way back to Edinburgh and retaken the town. Charles thinks that the decision to retreat spells doom for the army. Murray may think so too, but Murray also sees that attacking spells doom. Ah, oh, well, 1st of February 1745 and the Jacobites can march off towards their doom. Well, I say march, but perhaps shamble is a better word. Troops are deserting, leaders are dissenting, but they will get to Inverness and take the place. There'll be a few bits and pieces of victories, but a major problem is when a large amount of gold goes missing. Charles has also worked out by now that no Frenchy army is on its way. He's on his own. This is going really badly. The retreat all the way to Inverness meant giving up the eastern coastlands, where we did actually have a lot of faithful Jacobites. It also had the ports where the Frenchies could sail in. It could have been a base for recruiting and tax gathering. Oh well, it's gone. 28th of February, and in sails a Frenchy convoy with 700 much-needed reinforcements. They're in Aberdeen, and this would be no problem for us, my dear listener. We could just make a quick phone call to Charles, and we'd meet up with him pretty soon after. But there's no mobile phones. So the Frenchies could find no Jacobites, but had the news that Willie should be on his way to Aberdeen, so the Frenchies are off. And there you go, missed opportunity. Meanwhile, the Duke of Cumberland is taking his time. He's in no rush. He can move on into Aberdeen and rule it like a conquered city. His army have the best equipment and are getting the best training. Charles is set up in Inverness with guys out looking to recruit Highlanders and eliminate isolated government garrisons around the place. The guy we'd really like to get is the Earl of Loudoun, who has hard men he has gathered from weak types. Loudoun will evade the Jacobites and get to the Black Isle. Here comes the Duke of Perth, who we know is no military type at all. He will send his guys in via rowing boat, saying, "Go straight at them, lads, and bugger me, this will work out to be the most accomplished assault so far." Perth has done it, with Loudon's guys running away, some heading to Skye and the rest off to the Mackays in the far north. Loudoun had left a garrison at Inverness, which the Jacobites will besiege. Those guys will give up pretty quick, so we can move on to Fort Augustus at Loch Ness, and that will surrender. But Fort William at the other end of the lock will be tough going, and, oh no, the Jacobite best gunner, Irish Colonel James Grant, will cop a wound that puts him out of action. They really needed that guy. Now, I want you to know, my dear listener, that Charles was right up to date with winner behaviour. That is, treat your captors well. Take an oath from the officers that they won't fight against you again, and they can be on their way. Offer medical treatment to those who need it. All the right lovely stuff. Murray was doing spectacularly well, besieging Blair Castle and holding a big mob of 5,000 Hessians, but the order came in to return to Inverness. Skirmishing has been going on by both sides, with both sides having little wins and losses. Whatever is Willie up to? Well, he's happy in Aberdeen, which is a great place for getting supplies in, and he's still training his guys. But in fact, it's more. He has an understanding of Highland tactics by now, and gets that this needs to be broken. He understands that bayonets work differently to swords. They're more like the old Roman spatter, which required discipline and troops working together. He will reinforce his concern for the welfare of the troops. At the end of the day, the troops are learning to proceed with caution, move forward in an orderly manner, with artillery following nicely. The less controllable cavalry can be kept more in reserve. Willie is taking this all very seriously. Jacobite command is still squabbling. Systems are breaking down, particularly in the quartermaster department. That means men are going hungry. Pay is not happening, which is always bad news. But 25th of February, in comes the Frenchy sloop Le Prince Charles with plenty of cash. Oh, bugger. It's being chased by an English flotilla, but the guys will manage to get the treasure ashore and be making their way inland when Loudon's men find them. Lord Cromarty and his son will mount a daring rescue of the Jacobites with 500 guys, but they'll also be captured, sentenced to death, and then pardoned. Yeah, jaunty little song there about Charles winning the Battle of Preston thingy. Charles is still keen for biff with Willie. Winter is over and Willie had done a lot of training, so he's good to go. Now there's the thing, Willie's guys have done a lot of training. Willie still is proceeding with caution, but any Jacobite resistance along the way will be easily dealt with. Charles, on the other hand, is waiting for guys to return after winter. The McPhersons and McGregors won't arrive in time. Willie will get to Nairn, That's 15 miles out of Inverness, so Charles will head out to meet him. Willie once again had no trouble taking Nan, with just a few horse and 28 Irish guys there to oppose him. Charles can pick the terrain. Lots of argy-bargy at the council meeting, as you would expect. Perhaps the smart guys were the ones who said we need to withdraw into the Highlands and do a bit of the guerrilla stuff. But Charles wants a conventional army, and it would be hard to maintain any sort of cohesion in the Highlands. Murray then will come up with some very sensible ideas about where to place the Jacobite army. So, we won't do that. No, we shall listen to the Irishman, Colonel John William O'Sullivan, who incidentally is the quartermaster who has failed to properly feed the troops. O'Sullivan, it would seem, knows even less than me about how the Highlanders fight, because he has selected flat, open ground, Dromossi Moor. I guess our guys have had experience of fighting troops and found them to be inexperienced and very good at running away. They aren't to know that Willie has been thinking hard and trained his guys. Willie has also been reinforced by expert gunners of the Royal Artillery. You can see a very nice target in the Jacobites. We should also take into account that our Highlanders have no clue about fighting a defensive battle. They just want to rush on over and get stuck in. That's their battle plan. Same one every time. See the old Harry Hotspur plan, isn't it? And Joan of Arc. Just rush over and get stuck in. Okay, says Murray. I have a cunning plan, my lord. How about we march overnight and hit Willie in his own camp? Oh, great! This is fantastic. I think that's a fabulous idea, Murray. And it's action, and it's just what we want. Murray will take the lead with 1,200 guys. Charles, together with the Duke of Perth, will follow with 2,400 more. The plan is we'll all travel down Moor Road, which is just a track, really. Then Murray will turn south, he'll cross the River Nairn and get round behind Willie to take him up the arse. Oh yes, a bit of arse action there. Charles and Perth will keep going straight ahead and attack the front. What a fantastic plan. Off we go into heavy rain. Murray will end up thinking, oh shit, the plan seems to have all gone to hell. Surely Charles has gone home. And so he'll turn back. Off he goes, trudging back to Culloden, totally missing Charles. Charles, who doesn't think it's all gone to hell and is still going. Charles and his guys will get to within earshot of Willie's camp when the news comes in that Murray had gone back. So, once again, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, slightly different circumstances, and this could have been a win for Charles, but he and his Jacobites will be turning back. Now, I wish to, at this point, pause and tell you about a thingy called a docudrama made in 1964 called Culloden. Amazing for its time. Well, I think it's still quite amazing now. I hadn't had a look at it. And I couldn't have just a quick look. I had to watch the whole hour and a bit of it because I still thought it was really good. Now, the production values aren't what they are in the 21st century, but amazing stuff. Totally free for you on YouTube. Anyway, I was what you call a latchkey kiddie. That is, Mum and Dad were not home all the time, leaving me plenty of time to watch whatever I wanted to on telly. And so, somewhere around 1964, I watched Culloden, which was very, very, very different from my schoolboy history lessons. It's one of the early thingies that got me into history. So I recommend you have a squeeze, my dear listener. Culloden, the 1964 docudrama.
Wednesday, April 16th, 1746. This is the advance battalion of an English government army of 9,000 men.
Here, just a little bit of the opening there of that docudrama. What's that all about? Bloody dicky birds, eh? On it today, aren't they? Daylight, we're all back at Culloden, exhausted and starving, with our leaders all yelling at each other. Murray has told Clan Donald that they can't have their traditional place of honour on the right wing. Cameron of Lochleel was blaming Murray for the overnight failure. It's the 16th of April 1746 and Willie's 25th birthday. The troops got to celebrate with a nice big breakfast and happy that last night they scored a ration or two of hard liquor. They can happily be on the march at 5:15 a.m. feeling rather invincible. Willie's lads will soon spot the Jacobites on Drumussy Moor. It isn't all the Jacobites, some are still on the road from that failed overnight attack. And of course, some are still on their way, haven't even arrived yet.
Charles Edward Stuart, regent claimant to the thrones of England and Scotland, has more Scots in arms against him than for him. And ranged against him in the Highlands, he has the Whig clans siding with the government, the Munros, the Rosses, the Mackenzies, the MacLeods of Skye, the Sutherlands, and here on the moor, the Campbells of the Argyll militia.
The Redcoats are going to do something that they haven't particularly done before. They will bring up the artillery and just start banging away while the troops can just stay in formation and watch. The Jacobites will say, OK, well, two can play that game and start banging back, but they can't really match the English equipment or gunners.
Ordered by O'Sullivan to stand in ranks 6 deep, the men on the Highland right make a clear and tight-packed target for the English gunners.
It isn't that big a deal because it's something new and the government gunners are aiming for targets at the edge of their range. Even so, your podcaster would not be standing fast with those Jacobites. Nut, I'd be on the run already. The government cavalry started to work their way around the flanks. Charles has figured out that Willie isn't doing the standard type of attacking, so with some of his guys being blown to bits, he will let them off the leash for the ferocious Highlander charge that has scared the shit out of the enemy at Preston Pans and other places. Trouble is, this time the Highlanders have to charge into cannon fire and troops shooting at them. And it's worse, of course. It is no longer cannon balls, but canisters being fired. That's the stuff we call grape shot. Lots of metal shrapnel or whatever coming at you. Making it even worse is that the Jacobite right went charging off nicely, while the centre got a bit tangled up with guys trying to move away from the canister shot, and three of the centre's leaders went down. So these guys are now leaderless. The Jacobite left had wet ground across, so they went slowly, and they also had the furthest to go. The Jacobite right centre will do okay, messing up the government line, but they can't break through. The rest of the redcoats are just holding their ground. The Duke of Perth leading this mob will be out front yelling at the government troops in an attempt to get them to fire early, but the government boys will maintain discipline. It's tough going for the Jacobites, so perhaps from frustration, they'll try a bit of long-distance firing of their muskets, but that will do absolutely nothing. Eventually, some will wander into the range of the enemy cannon and be blown to bits, with others trying to run away now. Those Highlanders in the place of honour on the right will cop the worst of the canister and musket shooting, but get to the English lines. There they can be ferocious with some redcoats going down. The redcoats, though, will stick to their training and their bayonets are getting inserted into the Highlanders. As well as that, Willie's got the whole thing covered. He will just send in reinforcements in an orderly manner to march around the side and fire into the flanks of the Highlanders. Before you know it, the Highlanders are stuffed. It will be a rout, but not all Jacobites are running away. The government dragoons on the chase will lose a few horses and men. In comes a guy to Charles's bodyguard to say, "You see, it's all going to pot. You can be of no great succour, So before a general deroute, which will be soon, seize upon the prince and take him off. So just in case you've heard the story that Charles was a big girl's blouse at this particular battle, then he wasn't. He was always brave, just a bit stupid, that was the problem. There were some regular Frenchy soldiers on Team Jacobite, and those guys will make a stand that will allow Charles to be carted off. Those guys will actually mostly be safe, but as for the fleeing Highlanders, Bill the Butcher wants them all. We've had two teams, both led by a prince. Both teams had English and Scottish troops, both teams had Frenchies. Huguenots for the government and regular Frenchies for the Jacobites. The Jacobites had Irish, the wild geese, and for all I know, the government had some Irish too. On that basis, all I can say is, what a fucking stupid battle. It isn't quite over, but let's have a look at the score. Around 1,500 to 2,000 Jacobites dead or wounded. The official prisoner list gives us 154 Jacobites and 222 guys from French units. These would be regular Frenchies and those wild Irish geese guys. Irish wild geese, whatever they are. There were already 172 of the Earl of Cromart's men captured the previous day from a small engagement in Little Ferry. Government reports 50 of theirs are dead and 259 wounded, and a heck of a lot of wounded won't make it. A whack or two from a Highlander with his axe is pretty difficult to come back from. In come some Highlanders running away to Inverness, and there is the master of Lobat, Simon Fraser, who's a Jacobite chieftain. He will smartly assess the running away Highlanders means Jacobite defeat, so he will now identify as loyal government type with the pronouns of smart and arse. Having bagged the guy, his servants later said Simon would have stayed home and read a good book during the whole thing, but his dad was a total horror show who forced Simon onto the Charlie cause. This is actually one of those we'll never know for sure stories, but Simon will survive all this and go on to have a big career. Simon was marching his guys out of Inverness, but as he saw the guys running away, it was, about face and return home. The Lowlanders will head south to Corryborough and on to Rutherford and Barracks, while the Highlanders will head to Inverness and on to Fort Augustus. But let us not yet leave the battlefield, where Willie is showing that he is not at all like Charles with the care of the enemy wounded. No, these Jacobites and their allies are just vermin, so lads go old school. Just wander around, kill any you find alive. This is where he will earn his name, the Butcher, but he is not done yet. We'll find out more about Willie next week and see what's going on with Charles. This week it's a book, The Last Witch of Scotland by Philip Parris. Yeah, not quite correctly named there, I thought, because the last witch is actually that woman we met in the witch special during the Second World War. She was the last woman to be charged with witchcraft, but this is about the last person executed in Britain for witchcraft. And it's an interesting little novel. It's got a backstory the guys invented for two women who were charged with witchcraft, and gives us an engaging story about some travelling players and so on. Makes it quite nice. But our two women will be charged with witchcraft. The daughter actually escaped, according to history, but the mother, sadly, because we're in Scotland, was burned alive. The history around this woman is not that good, and you can see why the government won't want to do too much to give us a clear story of this particular judicial bit of murder. Very nasty death for the poor woman, who it seems was suffering a little bit from dementia. That was her main problem, whereas the daughter had some kind of deformity around her hand and feet. That was her problem. Not a bad read for you, The Last Witch of Scotland, Philip Parris. But for us, it's just a matter of what we go out with. And I've been feeling a little bit, I think it's the 80s. maybe Transvision Vamp. What do you reckon? I want your love. Hope to see you next week. Bye.